things would have happened to a point where you wouldn't turn back or couldn't turn back. So they came and they said, sir, we're ready to go. We'd like a decision. I said, I want to know something before you go. How many people will be killed? In this case, Iranians. I said, how many people are going to be killed? Sir, I'd like to get back to you on that. Great people, these generals. They said, came back, said, sir, approximately 150. And I thought about it for a second. I said, you know what? They shot down an unmanned drone, mm-hmm. plane, whatever you want to call it. And here we are sitting with 150 dead people that would have taken place probably within a half an hour after I said, go ahead. Yeah. And I didn't like it. I didn't think it was proportionate.
That was President Donald Trump on Meet the Press in an interview that was taped Friday and aired Sunday. Since then, a lot of news has developed on the Middle Eastern front. Hello, everyone. Welcome to the Editor's Roundtable edition of the Reason podcast. I am Matt Welch, joined by colleagues Peter Suderman, Nick Gillespie, and Catherine Mangu Ward. How are you, pals?
Good morning.
Hey, Matt.
Happy Negroni week.
It's not a thing, Peter. It's just not a thing.
It's not a thing for you.
We're doing this on a Monday morning, as we always do. I'm not going to tell you when and where, because I don't want there to be any terrorist attacks. But Secretary of State Mike Pompeo this morning, as we speak, is in Riyadh, meeting with Saudi officials about building a supposedly global coalition against Iran in the wake of last week's shooting down of a drone and the aforementioned American retaliatory strike that was pulled back at the last minute, reportedly due, at least in small part, to the president's conversations with Tucker Carlson, because 2019. Catherine, I want to start narrowly with you with just the quote we heard from Donald Trump. Is it not refreshing and overdue to hear an American president be kind of explicit about the awfulness of war and the concept of proportionality?
You know, as I was listening to that quote, I sort of hung on when he paused right before the last word, because I thought he was going to say wrong. I thought he was going to say, and it seemed to me that killing a bunch of innocent civilians for what was essentially arcane diplomatic protocol is wrong. And then he said, not proportionate. And both of those things are worthy of consideration. And yes, I do find it refreshing, actually, that like just for a hot second, our narrative about warlike behavior is centered largely around the death of innocents, which it should be much more so most of the time. But I still, I thought we were going to get like the moral case against the death of innocents, and instead we got the strategic case against the death of innocents, which is a different thing.
Let's call that a win, though. To be quite honest,
I literally wrote a headline on the post that we published about this last week that I think was like, Donald Trump is right, don't kill Iranian babies. Like, it's Donald Trump is right.
There are many things to be worried about in terms of Trump's foreign policy, which has to be put in the context of American foreign policy in the 21st century, which is a total cluster fudge disaster. And he's better at it, I think, so far than Obama or Bush, at least in terms of actual strikes and things like that. And he did as his wont, he went on Twitter after he called things off. And it was this kind of radical act of presidential transparency, explaining why he called it off. Obviously, there's some questions about exactly what happened, when, et cetera. But I think it's good. It's also good, you know, there's both talks as well as sanctions coming and things like that. I think, you know, Trump does not have a grand plan, which is both a blessing and a curse. It can be a curse. If it was Hillary Clinton's grand plan, we would be in the Middle East in a very, very bad and ineffective way, following up, from her Libya comments and her complicity in the Obama administration's foreign policy, which was disastrous. But I think, you know, this is the type of thing where Trump is scrambling jets all over the place, and he, you know, the way that he talked about this, the way that he both seemed to be going into action and then pulling back, people are going to laugh and make fun of it. But I think the outcome is better, and the process that's getting underway might end up being better as well.
Wasn't your heart, though, a little teeny bit? Well, I won't ask you. My heart.
Yeah, my heart. I haven't heard from my heart in years.
With the general in that conversation. Like, when he, because, you know, you're like, okay, I'm I'm a muckety muck. I'm a fancy general. I'm in here briefing the president. We've all agreed. We've talked about this. We are about to go do a strike. This is what we do. And he's like, I'm sorry. Hold on. Are people going to die?
But that's good.
And that's like,
you know?
It's not wrong to ask that question.
Yeah.
It is procedurally wrong to ask that question in that moment. And
I think that's so. Fuck the generals. The generals have brought us to ruin.
I don't like feeling sympathetic to the generals, but I do think like
the only general,
there's a reason we don't normally do it this way.
The only general worth listening to is the car insurance general who pals around with Shaquille O'Neal.
I would also add the General Lee, the car in Dukes of Hazzard, the TV show, though.
I thought that car, Matt, is objectively racist. I mean, it has a Confederate battle flag on its roof, Matt. Are you really going to defend that? Who are you, Joe Biden? You're defending segregation of shows from the 70s?
I'm just going to have conversations with
you.
Yeah,
you want to live in
cars.
Carter country.
Oh, my God. I forgot that show. Peter, rescue us here. Of course, that was not the only quote from Trump. Even in that interview, I will read you another one. I'm not looking for war, and if there is, it'll be obliteration like you've never seen before. But
it's good.
But
he's obviously read a lot of Sergeant Rock comics, you know, growing up. He understands war.
But I'm not looking to do that. You can't have a nuclear weapon. You want to talk? Good. Otherwise, you can have a bad economy for the next 3 years. Even if Trump has seemingly pretty good instincts about not going to war, and I think that he does, and we haven't gone to a big new war or even, you know, toppled a regime for the first time in a presidency since I can basically remember. However, isn't it fair to say, Peter Suderman, that the way that Trump campaigned in the election and has governed as president specifically toward Iran has, regardless of whether he has a bunch of Iran hawks in his administration, which, by the way, he totally does. But by saying that the Iran nuclear deal is the worst deal ever and withdrawing from the deal and siding on the side of Saudi Arabia whenever possible in these regional things, hasn't he been marching us towards this conflict anyways?
It sure seems like there's an answer built into your rather long question there.
Yeah. Thank you.
I guess I agree with your characterization of Trump's seemingly pretty good instincts on not going to war. He does have those, and that is probably why we are not engaged in a more aggressive military conflict with Iran right now. On the other hand, it is possible that the reason we got to the brink of war is because Trump, at the urging of hawks like Mike Pompeo, Secretary of State, pulled out of the Iran deal. It is possible that
he campaigned on that before, right. Way before Pompeo was even a gleam in.
But he has been urged on by hawks who he hired, by Bolton, by Pompeo and others, and those folks have really taken the driver's seat in terms of Iran policy within the administration. And Trump, of course, has the ability, as we saw that just last week, to resist them, and does at times, and does at I think a crucial moment, and should be commended for doing so. But the administration's posture towards Iran is one of aggression in a lot of ways, or at least of kind of standoffishness. And that has contributed towards getting us to this situation. And while I also agree that it is very good to hear a president say a few minutes before a strike is about to happen, by Trump's account, it was 10 minutes before. Wait, how many people are going to die? Oh, wait, 150? Let's not do that. That's a good thing. The New York Times did report that he was told he was given a possible casualty count, a range of 0 to 150 much earlier in the day, and could have at that point focused on that number, but didn't because he's Donald Trump and doesn't focus on things early.
Again, I mean, like if we take this out of context, and I realize, I think as today's conversation develops, I'm feeling warmer towards Trump than normal, to be quite honest. But you know, when you put it in the context, not of like, oh, Donald Trump is insane, is crazy, has attention deficit disorder, all of this kind of stuff, where we are in American foreign policy now is not good, but it is not worse. And it in many ways is better than it was under Obama or Bush. And I think that's the big takeaway. And there's no question, if you were a Republican candidate running in 2016, you were against the Iran deal. You, with the exception maybe of Rand Paul, you were going to pull out of that thing, you know, faster than a dime store whore. And it was, this is like, you know, so that's not the defining issue here. The defining issue is that Trump has talked about getting out of Syria. He is widely criticized, and the Middle East, he's widely criticized for withdrawing, taking America off of the international stage. And what happens with that is that there's going to be one-off, conflagrations or engagements and things like that, some of which may be better or worse or more justifiable than others. But we're going to have more things like this. And to me, this is, it's a better place to be talking, you know, having this conversation than the one that we would have had if the Hawks had won this argument or if Hillary had won the election. We'd be stuck so deep into the Middle East, it would be, you know, it'd be 2010 all over again.
I said last week that I think that this is one of the few ways in which I am truly glad that Donald Trump is president, because while the overall situation would probably be somewhat different with Hillary Clinton in office, it is quite likely that we would be engaged in, if not an all-out major, you know, 100,000 troop style war, some sort of recurring kind of we do strikes every couple of weeks, or we run a series of strikes for a few weeks, and then there's some talks, and then strikes happen again, that we would be much more militarily entangled in the Middle East than we are with Donald Trump. And so, you know, I in some ways, I don't want to credit his administration, but his instincts are the best we've seen in many decades in the White House. And there is something to be said for his instinctive way of governing, even if it is ad hoc and chaotic at times, when it leads to better than the alternative results like this.
I'm curious how this all plays into it. And this is the thing that is, you know, it's I guess it's both comforting and troubling to me, but I don't get a sense that Trump, and actually like no recent American president or even people who are serious contenders for presidency, have a global kind of approach to foreign policy and to diplomacy and military action and whatnot. But, you know, Matt, you mentioned Pompeo is in Riyadh. What are those conversations looking like? And, you know, the U.S. spent under Bush and Obama, they destroyed the great regional kind of bulwark against both Saudi Arabia and against Iran. We've destabilized the region. You know, there's all kinds of fuck ups going on. But, you know, Iran is a major oil supplier, energy supplier to China. Saudi Arabia, the only thing they have going for them is oil. You know, they understand they're reduced as a world power because oil and energy has shifted, the politics of that, the economics of that. It would be interesting, it would be helpful to know what's going on in Riyadh, why, and what are the global implications of this, not just for the Middle East, but, you know, for China, which is certainly, you know, I don't think it's a Cold War. I don't think we should be in a trade war with China, but they're the other major kind of player in geopolitics. And, you know, is all of this stuff connected somehow or not?
So actually, I have a question for everybody, since it's a thing that I've been thinking about and I'm not sure of myself. You know, we've talked about Trump's advisors and how he's recruited this very hawkish set of advisors, but then he has another informal set of advisors that includes, apparently, Tucker Carlson, who talked him out of, who was at least influential in talking him out of
it's just good that that Lou Dobbs didn't pick up.
And so, yeah, right? Which, and like, I mean, there were, you know, if you watched Tucker on, I think it was Thursday night when all this was happening, Tucker was all, well, you know, this is, the hawks in the administration are marching us into war. And then an hour later, Hannity, who of course also has Trump's ear, was like, we have to show strength, and Iran is baiting us, you know, and we need to be show resolve. And it's really sort of interesting. But here's my question that I actually don't think I know the answer to, is Donald Trump, by bucking the Republican Party's hawkish consensus, actually changing the party? If Donald Trump, say, doesn't win in 2020, or if once Donald Trump moves on after 2024, is anything going to have changed? Because it sort of seems to me like, aside from Donald Trump and a couple of notably influential but still TV hosts, there isn't an elite movement in the Republican Party, not necessarily amongst Republican voters, but there isn't a movement in the Republican party apparatus to adopt a less hawkish stance towards the rest of the world.
I think, Peter, that if you look at polling, which is not polling of elites, it's polling of actual Republicans and humans, across a variety of measures, Trump has changed public opinion among Republicans, changed it in an incredibly noticeable way in regards
but do,
to...
But do, d- does the lumpen,
no,
you
know,
voter-tariat, you know...
towards Russia, for example, towards Vladimir Putin, a huge difference in change of public opinion on that, a huge difference in the change of opinion on international trade, which we're going to talk about in a half a second here. And so because politicians respond ultimately to incentives, and the incentive is to get reelected, to the extent that those values become sticky, that last longer than a president, it's quite plausible that Trump revealed some longstanding currents in American public opinion and Republican or conservative Republican public opinion that had been ignored by elites for a long time. I mean, generally speaking, Americans are less interventionist than their leaders, and there's a gap there. And all gaps like that are arbitrages for opportunity. And Trump, regardless.
We know what you meant.
I'll just say quickly.
So one small point is that I would like that to be true, but the next generation of Republican lawmakers, to me, the people who are following Trump, they look to me like Tom Cotton, who is a super hawk on nearly everything. And so I'm not sure I see a change in the party, in the sort of elite party apparatus that is following Trump here, at least not yet. In fact, I see a sort of a strengthening of the kind of hawkish credentials amongst younger Republican leaders.
I think a lot of it, think a lot of it depends on, first off, to understand that elites probably more than any other area of policy control foreign policy, because it really is not a high priority to most American voters. So they feel free to disregard it and then explain decisions later. But that Republican foreign policy is as much of anything, it's a function of Democratic foreign policy. And there has been a moving away, I think, from a kind of Bill Clinton and Hillary Clinton and even Joe Biden-esque kind of global projection of force. When you look at all of the leaders of, in the Democratic presidential field, they are all, you know, anti-interventionists. They're all like Rand Paul or further to the left in terms of, rejecting the idea that we should be the indispensable nation. I think the Republican elite is going to, you know, look at that and define themselves against that. And hopefully whoever emerges, whether it's in, after Trump loses in 2020 or steps down in 2024, that there might be a new consensus, because I think it would be better if we were less interventionist and if we talked about diplomacy and trade much more than military adventurism. But there may come a time where, and this is hard to remember, but for most of the Cold War, there was an absolute consensus, one that was problematic, but between Democrats and Republicans in the Cold War, and it was interventionist. But I think we may, hopefully in 2024, Peter, we would have a Republican establishment which has kind of helped firm up a new consensus, which is one that the United States should not be, the militarily and indispensable nation around the globe.
Isn't there a tight alternate history there, though, where if Joe Biden wins and if we essentially do have four more years of, Clintonite foreign policy, in that case, like, I find it basically impossible to imagine that Republicans, flip all the way around and become, they move to the dovish side of Democrats, in which case they're going to move.
Well, the one possible thing is that depending on how Biden gets elected, he may have to curtail his, and he is a foreign policy guy. That's one of his like big supposed expertises. And if depending on what his hold within the Democratic Party is, he might have to give up his, his interventionism as part of the price of being president.
I think the price of being president is going to be much more likely something of the Elizabeth Warren, Bernie Sanders,
Yeah.
If you let me be president, I'll give you free college.
Why are we only talking about free college? Why aren't people making money going to college? That would be good. I mean, if banks get money just for having deposits.
What if undergraduate becomes like
the new UBI?
Graduate school? Yeah. Jesus.
So speaking of Trump's idiosyncratic, unorthodox views of the world, President, the tweeter in chief, wrote what I think was an unusually important tweet over the weekend, not necessarily because it, led to any decision making or anything like that, but it was, I think it stated pretty plainly kind of his view on American history and his view on economics. I will read the tweet now. When our country, capital C, had no debt and built everything from capital H highways to the military with cash, we had a big system of tariffs. Now we allow other countries to steal our wealth, treasure, and jobs. But no more. The USA is doing great with unlimited upside into the future. I hear versions of this from people whose intellects I have more respect for than I do the president's necessarily, which is to say that American 19th century history, we became a great power while tariffing the crap out of stuff, and we didn't have an income tax. So, Catherine, I put it to you, as the editor, the director of ceremonies at all of our awards banquets. In what way is the president wrong or right in that statement?
He is right, roughly speaking, in his description of the tax structure of the early United States. I think this is something people broadly don't understand, right? We have this sense that the income tax existed forever, will exist forever. You know, when people think of death and taxes as the two constants, they think of the income tax, and that's not right at all. The income tax is a pretty late-breaking turn of events in U.S. history. So it is worth pointing out that taxation used to look very different. However, our economy used to look very different. Our economy used to look so different, in fact, that the easiest and most efficient point of taxation was import-export, was tariffs. And you know, that simply isn't the case anymore. I am always wary, of course, of golden ageism. I've said many times on this podcast, it is definitely never true when people start to tell you a story about how things used to be so much better. And I think that we would do well to remember that under a big system of tariffs, as Trump describes it, we also had a lot of war. And that's not a coincidence.
Peter, Catherine says that it was easy to collect those tariffs at the time. No more. Why no more? Why wouldn't it work?
Well, I would dispute that sometimes it wasn't easy.
Well, I just mean it's easier, for example, to collect other kinds of tariffs, of taxes now.
As for example, when the British tried to tax
tea. Right, that's what I'm saying. There was war. There was a bunch of war sometimes when these tariffs were collected.
The other thing, though, that's wrong about that tweet is that he sort of frames America's rise to greatness as being during a time of high tariffs. And while certainly 1800s America had its strengths and was a time of sort of a period of growth and, sort of growing power in the world, America became a great power in the World War II era and after. And in the aftermath of World War II, we entered into a bunch of agreements to limit tariffs and to try and reduce them and to try to integrate the global economy, in part to try to prevent stuff
war.
Like World War II, and also because it turned out to be quite good for a growing economy. That, and so, I think Trump's idea that tariffs are the key to a great and strong nation is just wildly wrong.
But again, I want to just point out the weird genius of Trump's
capitalization.
Inaccurate phrasing or his sort of blurry phrasing, right? Like he says, we had, first of all, he says we paid for the highways and the military with cash, all capitals, cash, which just love that. But also he says we had a big system of tariffs. What does that mean? If you're giving him benefit of the doubt, if you're
nope.
parsing this tweet, on the black letter text, it's not actually clear he's saying high tariffs. It's not clear. Is it the system of tariffs? Is it the bigness? Like, this is every Trump quote is like this, is what I'm saying. He always, when you look closer at his words, isn't saying the thing that his words strongly imply.
So don't take him literally, right? I mean, this is, think about the 1950s, though. Tariffs, trade was, tariffs
were
higher.
Can I make that sigh any louder?
Tariffs were higher. You know, we also pass gas taxes and things, and like the interstate highway, the finances of the federal government after World War II were in better shape than they are now. What I find problematic about this stuff, as Catherine pointed out, is the nostalgia for a supposed period where everything was good and glorious in America. And if you go back and you look at the 19th century, whether it's railroads or canals or whatever, all of that stuff is, you know, among the worst kinds of boondoggles and giveaways. And, you know, if you think we have eminent domain problems now, go ask the Indians, you know, about the westward expansion of railroads and things like that. But in the post-war era, we could do different types of infrastructure projects, and we could do them now. Trump is not talking about them for various reasons, but there is so much foreign capital dying to build American roads and bridges and upgrade toll systems and harbors and ports and things like that. And I wish we would be having that kind of conversation, especially in a post-war on terror moment. You know, things were moving, and Bob Poole at the Reason Foundation has written a lot about this, especially in periods where state and local governments, which do a lot of this stuff, are totally strapped for cash, and the federal government certainly is. There is massive amounts, I mean, trillions of dollars of foreign capital dying to do stuff, you know, for us, and then taking a cut of you know, the operating profits or revenues. And we need to be getting there rather than kind of, I think, debating Trump's stupid capitalization or his blurry, nostalgic view of America, which is clearly wrong, but is not any different or is not any more ridiculous than, you know, what you're going to hear from the Democrats, that is like, oh, well, you know, we need to have massive infrastructure building, and it's going to become a jobs program, and we're just going to tax bazillionaires. And then everything will be good and glorious again, like it was in the past.
I think that Trump's ideology, which is strong on this, is worth discussing at all times, because it's affecting things. It affects his policy, and it also affects the way that conversations on any side of any political spectrum is going. I would offer a small proposed theory. Nick, you mentioned infrastructure and all this money that's waiting around. I'm reminded also of the conversation that was happening last week on Capitol Hill. There was a hearing having to do with reparations, which is being talked about in ways that really couldn't have imagined a few years ago. I think just today or over the weekend, Bernie Sanders announced a new free college type of thing. There's a lot of kind of check writing being proposed elsewhere. Trump had around him on his transition team and also in the Department of Transportation people who know who got Bob Poole on speed dial, who know this piles of billions, trillions of dollars are out there that could be tapped into with some not even particularly creative legislation writing, just as Donald Trump has around him a bunch of people who disagree with the specifics and the broad ideology behind his tweet that we're talking about here. I would suggest that politicians fundamentally, and Peter, I'll let you kind of riff on this since it overlaps with a couple of your concerns, fundamentally prefer not working from a desired solution and getting there with the best possible policy necessarily. But they really love writing checks. They really love, I'm going to send money this way to this group of people. Did you notice that I sent money your way? If you're in the case of George W. Bush, we're actually going to send you a check, even though it's going to cost us more money in your tax rebate, but just so you know, it's a check. That there's more interest in an infrastructure bill, and this is why Democrats held their nose and they're going to block anything. Like, no, we want to spend all that money. We don't want it, that evil privates to be spending the money. We want to write the checks. Peter, how much of our policy is a desire to write and send checks rather than to work like backwards from a desired policy aim and fix things better?
Once again, it's a question where I feel like the answer is perhaps embedded
in the question.
I think the primary goal of most elected officials is to stay elected officials. And so even more than writing checks or promising to write checks or promising to build a bridge or get you a job or make your job better, what they want, their actual goal is to stay elected. And it's, I mean, kind of crazy given how many of them also seem to hate being elected officials. But there is sort of a mania that overtakes politicians. They're a weird type of people. They don't sleep very much. They are sort of relentlessly, almost sociopathically social, right? Like they need to shake every hand and have every person approving of them at all times. And one very good way to do that is to constantly promise to write checks and get you a job and build you a bridge and make sure that your kids always have everything forever paid for by somebody else. And so the doing of the writing of the checks is important, but it's secondary to this sort of weird, like, ingrained need for approval and deep, like, sort of unstoppable desire to get reelected as the ultimate sign that you are approved of and loved.
Can we talk real bit about the sleep, really quickly about the sleep thing? Because I don't know if you guys saw that incredible, the New York Times had really a great feature where they put the same questions to all 20.
Everybody except Biden, I believe.
Of the candidates, the Democratic candidates. And
ironically, Biden was asleep. He sleeps 18
and
hours a day.
The questions were just off kilter enough to elicit some interesting answers, and they did them all on video, and they created this sort of special landing page. I recommend that you check it out. But one of the questions was, how many hours of sleep do you get a night? And no one said more than six, I don't think.
And I think six was, like, the maximum was, I like to be able to get six.
Like, six,
right?
Was aspirational for these people. Now, that's bad. That's objectively bad. Like, there is so much science out there about how you need to sleep to make good decisions. I have come to the idea that more sleep is good later in my life. And I got to tell you, more sleep is good, y'all. But I went looking after I saw this feature specifically for some studies. And there's the one that really jumped out at me was that people are much more likely to overvalue potential gains and undervalue potential risks of decisions when they are sleep deprived. That's the worst possible quality in a president. Everybody needs to take a nap.
The president's Catherine might actually vote for a president if that if
you
that
know
person
who took
ran
a nap?
On
Calvin freaking Coolidge. He was a napper.
Let's not minimize
Bill Clinton's White House famously. Almost no one. Bill Clinton was like, I rarely get more than 4 hours of sleep. And like his top advisors were all kind of encouraged to like work on the four.
Well,
hours
you know, he is also a counterexample then, right? Because once he got hemmed in by the Republicans, things got better. They didn't get great or perfect, but they got better. So maybe we should be less invested.
Do you think that the sleep was
Saying, you know, we should be less invested in the people in the White House and more the larger power dynamics that either constrain or force certain decisions.
But all these politicians think they're going to be president. They've been training on the 4 hours of sleep mode for decades. Their brains are broken.
And this
they're
is
pure
if you
cortisol.
Have kids, you see this immediately when your kid has 2 or 3 days where they don't sleep and they become kind of retarded. I mean, they are dumber, objectively dumber than they were at the beginning.
I thought you were going to say, as a parent, you
become dumber.
Well,
that's a given because, I mean, being a parent is to lose sleep for decades, really. But no, there's no question of that. But the larger question, or the one that Matt started with, was the question about writing checks. What we're witnessing among the Democratic candidates right now, because you have the talk about reparations for slavery. Elizabeth Warren started talking about reparations for gay couples that could not file joint taxes. Together, et cetera. We are at the beginning of a process now where, for reasons that Peter has explored at length and I think very persuasively, when the Republicans were in power, they were like, we don't give a fuck about paying for anything. We are just going to promise more spending to old people, to military people, to our favorite constituencies, and we don't care how to pay for it. You know, Dick Cheney said deficits don't matter. That leads directly to AOC saying you just pay for the New Deal. Who cares? Like, you just pay for it. We're at the beginning of what is going to be one of the great feasts on the corpse of America, where every one of these 2,800 Democratic candidates is going to be promising more and more checks to more and more constituencies. And the purpose is explicitly to target audiences or constituencies that they need or think they need to get out. And that's one of the reasons why this is starting with reparations, is because the black vote did not turn out for Hillary Clinton. And all of the Democratic candidates are very mindful of that. And I think the Democratic Party is. And they want to make sure that they have the attention of the African-American community, whom Trump got, you know, he got under 10% of, but he did better than with blacks than Biden and Romney or McCain. And he's actually making some inroads. If you look at breakdowns of certain types of polls of approval of Trump among black men, et cetera, he's doing quite well. He's in double digits and, you know, and in the 20s or 30s in certain polls. That's what this is about. And it's going to be so ugly, but it's all predicated again, I think it's really important to go back to the Republican inability or unwillingness to talk about funding anything like they are, you know, paying for stuff. They just were like, put it on the credit card. That's what we're going to be seeing over the next, 16 months.
I mean, there's also a related drop in public concern about the deficit. If you go back to 2013, you had something like 72% of the American public thought that the deficit was a real and pressing problem, and now it's about 48%. And that's a very large drop in just a few years, and that is driven in part by politicians themselves, but also just by the sense that, well, you know, we've been doing this for a while and like there just don't seem to be any consequences. Yep. We should just keep doing this.
And
but
you
more.
Have the Fed now saying, you know, interest rates, we're going to keep them low. They've signaled clear, like the era of easy money. We don't know exactly where we are in it, but we know we're not, you know, according to the government, we're nowhere near the end as far as they're concerned.
But there is clearly, I think mistakenly and problematically, but there's clearly voter demand for more expansive government and more expansive social spending in particular.
Let's use that as a natural jumping off the ledge point about the Democratic debates that are going.
Remember,
to...
Remember, it's not bad until you hit the ground.
That's true.
Until then, it's kind of like a pleasant trip.
Catherine, what is the one thing? The one thing that you're most eager to watch, looking forward to much, could be the one more candidate, could be a discussion, anything. What is the thing that you are looking forward to on these debates besides alcoholism and a lot of sleep?
I am looking forward to the sheer raw tally of the promises that will be made on the debate stage over two nights. Like, just the number of proposals whose implementation would exceed $1 trillion will be astonishing. And while I don't think necessarily that that is going to sway anyone's vote, I don't think that anyone is going to listen to all of these people say, I'll do this, I'll do that, I'll do this, I'll do that, and say, you know what, actually it might be too much, precisely because of the aforementioned general kind of complacency and disregard for concerns about debt and deficit. But I personally will be imagining a little ka-ching dollar sign sound every time a new proposal comes up. And as Peter will, I am sure, rant again, as he has ranted before, you simply cannot pay for all of these ideas, all of these proposals by, you know, implementing the tippy top Elizabeth Warren wealth tax, which
it's
is
two
the
pennies.
Only the
Everybody's
only
got
person.
Two pennies. It's like Superman 2, right? You just put the pennies in the little thing next to the cash register.
Literally,
and then take
I have
the
no
pennies
idea
out.
What
it's like Office
about.
Space, which was also like Superman 2. You just take the pennies from the rich people, and that's
Wait,
it.
Wait, is that Superman 2, or is that the one with Richard?
No, Superman
Pryor
3.
The,
sorry, Super. I'm sorry.
Okay,
it's the yeah. Richard Pryor Superman
yeah,
3.
Yeah, Superman 2 is all about
that's
Zod.
Right. Superman 2 is the really
and,
good
and,
one.
And trust me right now, if Zod was running for the LP nomination, I would consider voting for Zod.
Are you sure he's not?
Yeah, that's
the
true.
The other thing that I'm looking forward to, just because I'm going to cheat and say two, is Tulsi Gabbard.
Okay. Suderman, what are you looking forward to?
I, too, am looking forward to the lack of debt and deficit talk and like the insistence that every single policy can be paid for with a wealth tax. Especially, we're going to get this a lot from Elizabeth Warren, who makes an argument that is so actually somewhat difficult to dismantle in real time, because she almost never says, oh, I'm going to pay for this, 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 and this, this, and this, all in one paragraph. She'll say, I'm going to pay for that with this tax. And then 10 minutes later, you'll ask her about something else. And she'll say, I'm going to pay for that with this tax. And it's the same one. And so it's cumulative, and you kind of have to track it all. But the other thing that I'm looking forward to is the battle of the geezers. On Thursday night, we are going to see Joe Biden and Bernie Sanders face off against each other.
Geese it out.
And there, yeah. It is going to be so awesomely geezy. And
How many answers will begin? I'm old enough to remember when. Actually, none, because only young people say that.
I'm old enough to forget. That's going to be the line.
It's, I mean, and like the two of them on stage together.
Can we get a double Admiral Stockdale moment?
It's going to be SNL skit.
I've forgotten who I am. I think I'm on my third honeymoon to Stalinist Russia. Yeah.
I'm looking forward to is actually, I want to see how the media, you know, the NBC hosts conduct themselves and if they ask questions, because this is, to me, one of the weird subtexts of the Trump era is that, you know, Trump is getting beaten up in the press every day. And I think that's good and proper. Oftentimes people overstate things or they interpret, as Catherine was pointing out, most of Trump's statements, I mean, he's like, you know, Henry II. He's constantly saying, you know, will people rid me of this turbulent priest or something? And then you can interpret it in all sorts of ways. He always gets the least charitable interpretation towards him, which is good and proper and fine, actually, although it ends up blowing up in the media's face a lot. But are, you know, Savannah Guthrie, Lester Holt, Chuck Todd, Rachel Maddow, and Jose Diaz-Balart, are they going to ask serious questions, like along the lines of Peter? And my main focus at this point is, are they going to talk about what do you do with the national debt? Is the national debt a problem? And if so, what do you plan to do about it? If it is not, why is it not? And then how do you pay for stuff in a serious way? And then the other thing that I'm interested in seeing, and actually I think this is a place where the Democratic candidates, particularly Sanders and particularly Elizabeth Warren, have done really good jobs of explaining in a large kind of brushstroke sense of the America that they want to live in. And to be honest, like, I disagree with their means of getting there. I think they're entirely wrong about stuff, but they put forward a vision of an inclusive America and one that is moving forward and that takes care of poor people and raises everyone up. I think politics, presidential politics needs more of that. And then it needs to be taken seriously. Like, how do you get there? But so those are the two things I'm interested in.
My prediction, and of course, you should never make a prediction in politics. So it's a narrow, small one. But is that we will be surprised to hear from some candidates, particularly candidates you could not pick out in a police lineup, which is to say more than half of them. The phrase that, you know what, that math doesn't add up. I think the objections that we bring up on this podcast are going to be reflected at least somewhat by the likes of like John Delaney, because there's a lot of guys polling at 0.3% who are not democratic socialists, who are trying to position themselves as being sensible in the face of the onslaught of economic leftism. So I think we'll hear some objections like that on the stage, maybe more from them than we will from the moderators themselves. Although maybe I'm just being optimistic. The thing that I'm looking forward to, my drinking game, is going to be private prisons. I don't know. I think I finally snapped on private prisons over the weekend. Is Bernie or Elizabeth Warren or both, you know, in laying out their vision of criminal justice reform, just kind of like, look, we have to start with, you know, abolishing private prisons. This one goes out to my homies in California, in New York, everyone else.
San Quentin.
If you think that the problem, that the fundamental, that one of the top five problems of the criminal justice system is the 7% or so of the prisons that are private, you're doing it backwards. This is a way to register an understandable, totally understandable disgust at profiting at other people's incarceration. I get that. That's respectable, and we can argue about the merits on that. What we can't argue about, when I'm sick of people accepting the argument of, is that is the reason that we have this over-carceral system, that those prisons and their lobbyists are affecting laws more than prison guards unions. That is a nonsense conversation, and I wish people would stop pretending that is a centerpiece, that is a big, meaningful chunk of criminal justice reform. It ain't. It just ain't. So,
that's also, I mean, it's a dog whistle. I mean, call it what it is. It's a dog whistle to certain aspects of the Democratic electorate. The same way, you know, and these two people have also gone after private charter schools, as if private charter schools are the, or for-profit charter schools are an issue. They're not. They're such minor players in educational reform. But that message is being sent to certain kinds of prison guards unions and prison builders and, you know, and constituencies in states that have large prison populations, that your public sector jobs and your public sector gigs are good with us. And it's the same thing with schools. And, you know, and that's, it's worth really holding, I think, the Democratic Party to, you know, their feet to the fire, the same way that Republican, you know, Republican constituents are, were constantly being reminded of why Trump says this or why Trump says that, or somebody says that. That's good. That's, I mean, we should be doing, exploring public choice analyses in the media all the time of where does the money go in politics and how do people move it around? But we should be doing that with the Democrats for sure.
I want to shift to our end of show. What is the stuff that you have been consuming? I'm going to cheat on that, but I'll save my cheating for a little bit later. But Suderman, let's start with you.
I saw Toy Story 4 and it was wonderful. It's just, it's so good. And it's so good again. And this, and the piece that I wrote, and I will just sort of restate my basic argument, is that at this point, I think you have to accept that it is at least plausibly, if not probably, the greatest franchise in modern cinema. There's no other set of movies that is so good, so consistent, and has been for so long. And this, it's four masterpieces or near masterpieces at this point. They're just truly great, delightful, meaningful, engaging, fun, kind of philosophical action children comedy. Like, they do everything. They do everything and they do it all well. And it's really a delight just to see a series that can maintain this level of interest and quality for almost 25 years at this point.
It's Peter, funny that you mentioned that, Peter, because I just said to my daughter, 10-year-old, this very morning, interrupting a sentence, much like I just interrupted Nick, before it got anywhere, with the comment, "I don't ever want to hear anything about the Toy Story franchise. I couldn't interest me less. Stop talking to me about it." Yes, Nick, you were going to say?
Oh, no, I was going to say, Peter, I'm really excited to hear that, and I want to definitely see it. Toy Story 3 was, I saw it in a theater with my older son who, you know, had grown up with the movie, and there was not a dry eye in the house. It is so incredible, and the idea that they could go on a fourth installment and deliver is really amazing, and that's fascinating to think
about. I watched Toy Story 3 again last week, and like, yeah, honestly, I teared up a little at the end. it's really good, and it's sharp and smart, and it's like, it's not manipulative in the sort of, you know, kind of hokey like Disney family movie way that you sort of expect. It's a kind of honest and emotionally a smart movie about what it means to grow up and move on. I would say that Toy Story 4 is not quite as good as Toy Story 3. So lower your expectations a little, but it is absolutely a fantastic movie. It's one of the best things I've seen this year. And it lives up to the franchise's historical greatness.
I think I should say that.
So it's better than the Fast and Furious. I mean, you're just putting it out there that it's better than the Fast and Furious franchise.
Yes, it is better than the Fast and Furious franchise, because the Fast and Furious franchise is not nearly as consistent. I think Tokyo Drift and Fast and Furious 2 are sort of like, they didn't know what the franchise was at that point. I also think the most recent one, which they switched directors, it had some sort of interesting action scenes at the end. I mean, there's a bit where the cars are being chased by a submarine that is coming up through an ice sheet. That's pretty good. That's pretty good movie making.
Catherine, save us.
I do, before I say my thing, I want to note that there was a great tweet last week, which was just, what if there was a series made out of the Little Women story, but the naming conventions were done like the Fast and the Furious movies? So just think about that.
I'm really looking forward to
Little
Hobbs
Women,
and Shaw, the
Massachusetts spin-off. Drift. I mean, there's a lot to be done there. My entry is a podcast that I just started listening to, recommended to me by a friend of mine and a listener of the Reason podcast, called The Anthropocene Reviewed. It's a WNYC pod, and the deal is that this dude, John Green, just reviews two things that humanity has done. And so the episodes are like Scratch and Sniff stickers and the Indianapolis 500, or like prom and the Stanford marshmallow experiment.
Does he draw like useful comparisons?
They are not. No,
like, is there any
that's
sort of
one thing that's great about it is he does not explicitly connect to the two things. He just reviews them like Yelp review style review, like prom. Would you like, did humanity do a good job? And it's
isn't the verdict still out on that?
It's delightful.
One, right?
I strongly recommend it for what, to my mind at least, is precisely the right level of weirdness. Like, I have a certain school marmish intolerance for like maximal weirdness. Like, I do not bring me your Manic Pixie Dream podcast. I will not have it. But this falls precisely 1 millimeter below the too weird threshold in a way that's very pleasing.
So you're saying you like 1965 Beach Boys and not 1968 Beach Boys?
Shut your face.
Thank you.
I think it's student demonstration. It's student demonstration time.
All the way down. That and transcendental meditation. I will do my cheat now, which is to say what I consumed since the last time we talked was a party, a Washington, D.C. Meet and greet for Bill Welt at a very rich person's house in the Kalorama Circle. Area.
Can you name that person's house?
Nah, prefer not to.
This was a Beltway cocktail party.
Yeah,
but
geez.
Not
it was
a Georgetown cocktail.
1,000%, 1,000% a Beltway cocktail party. Like literally two houses away from the Obamas. Like you can't get close to this house because there's a security checkpoint that you have to Obamite security checkpoint that you have to walk through.
And like five houses away from Jeff Bezos's house, I assume.
I presume so, and I think the French ambassador has a residence there nearby. Anyways, I bring it up for a couple of reasons. One, it's you know, always interesting to check in with Bill Welt and to see him in a room with Bill Kristol, so the great libertarian neoconservative dream ticket is slowly assembling force here. It's a crowded event. I've seen Bill Weld in a lot of different places over the last 5 years or so. I've never seen him more comfortable talking to a bunch of extremely rich Washington people about why how Trump is awful and should be replaced. It is a bipartisan crowd, but mostly I bring it up because at heart I'm a semi-rube from Long Beach, California. And man, rich people, they got weird houses. They are so, they're incredible. Like I felt, I wanted to peace out and just like walk around and take sneaky pictures of everything. They are different. I don't even understand. I felt like one of those Eastern Europeans who come to America or Vienna for the first time after living their lives in communism and walking into a supermarket and just kind of like experiencing Tharn, staring at all the consumer choice around them. Just marvelous and crazy and interesting.
Did it make you want to tax them to pay for the college bills of lawyers and doctors?
I just like, I couldn't wrap my head around anything. In terms of that, probably they get a wealth tax going. No, I don't know. It's just it's such a different world. Yeah, you think you've seen some things, but you haven't. Nick, what have you been consuming in a more cultural context?
I consumed an event last Thursday and Friday. I went to the Heterodox Academy annual convention or conference in New York. Heterodox Academy is a group that was co-founded by Jonathan Haidt and a couple of other academics to promote intellectual or ideological diversity among college faculty in particular. And so they had a two-day conference. This is the second one where they brought together a bunch of different speakers and panels to put together to talk about what's going on college campuses and what are the sources of a kind of intellectual orthodoxy on campus that shuts down all sorts of debate, not simply among students, which is important, or outside speakers, but actually among faculty. And it was really fascinating and really heartening. I think if people who are worried about universities having a monoculture that shuts out a lot of interesting ideas or allows for the kind of exploration of a wide range of intellectual viewpoints, would be heartened by this. The keynote, the final speech or talk was given by Steven Pinker, the Harvard linguist whose reason is interviewed and done a couple things with over the years. And he made the case for why universities should be have a particular role in kind of restoring or maintaining and developing and expanding civil rational discourse that is academically free and intellectually wide-ranging and exciting. It was a really well-done conference, and it made me feel good about the possibility of the university system becoming more open to more ideas.
Wow, that's a nice little splash of positivity here on a sunny summer's day. Awesome. Well, that's all the happy news that we have time to share with you here on the Editor's Roundtable edition of the Reason Podcast. Thank you all for listening. Keep sending us recommendations of other podcasts and feedback on what we're doing here. And you can also share that feedback with the world, iTunes, wherever the hell you find us, comment section at Reason, etc. Thanks again, and stay tuned throughout the week for other great, awesome Reason-y content on this podcast channel. Goodbye.